Julie, you're starting to read Hebrew on me? Kaiho Suni, Gar, Ayu, and Auto. Apo, Kaluk, Tatai. Righteousness for righteousness of or from God in it, it being the gospel, is revealed. That's the translation you have, correct? What you have is a piece of paper is blown up here that the camera may be able to pick up once in a while, but do it carefully and don't hang up on it, but get a good picture of it. There you go. You can see now, you that watch, what I'm talking about when I talk to the people about these letters underneath. This is a verb, the V. It's passive, which means that it's being received without the receptor doing anything. It is really being revealed in a process. And these words break down in the Greek. Apo is away from whatever this kaluptatai is, which we're going to talk about. Now you may say, when are you going to get on past this 17th verse? There is no more important verse in the Bible, in the history of the church, than this verse, Romans 1. 17. Let me show you something. In the relatively late in the history of Bible dictionaries, Anchor Bible Dictionary, a series thick and meaty, this is volume 5. Which tells you how vast this Bible dictionary is. Other important words occupy maybe a quarter of a page. Let me show you something. Righteousness starts. Let's try to get a camera that can see this. Can you pick it up? Righteousness starts here on page 724. And it goes on and on and on and on and on. Study of words, no less. And the roots of all words being translated righteousness and the history up through Sidak and Sadaka and the Old Testament and the DK words in the New Testament. And then here's a chart starting with Nehemiah, 2nd Esdras, and the Septuagint through books like Jubilees and Philo's writings. A chart of the use of words as they analyze and study righteousness. Greco-Roman world, Plato, Aristotle, Stoicism, righteousness and faith. Another chart of the use of the words related to dike and adike throughout all the books of the New Testament. And of course, 72 of the 302 references are in the book of Romans alone. That's the subject of the book of Romans. Righteousness. Righteousness by faith. And they make some comment and overview here about Jesus doesn't talk about it much. He doesn't use this word. There's they're sort of puzzled that there's a paucity of Jesus talking about righteousness, except when he's pinpointing the lack of it. As we have spent time and ultimately brought you to seeing, he is righteousness. For righteousness you substitute Christ. Now how ridiculous to say he didn't talk about it much. Because he came preaching himself. That's what makes him different. He's not going to talk about righteousness apart from himself because there isn't any. When he's there, he is righteousness. But I'll get on that a little later. How'd they get this funny pair of glasses that you can't find your ear with? Anyway, I wrote that comment in the margin there. Just on and on. Getting tired? And on. And on. Finally, they get to Paul. Linguistic overview, underlying factors, creedal and hymnic formulas, God's righteousness, apocalyptic content or context, and the Pauline core. On and on and on and on and on. And on. And then here's the bibliography if you want more. And because English borrows from two sources, the Latin jus and justice, law, and the Anglo-Saxon right. In fact, there have been attempts by scholars to try to find a way to state the verb that would match the verb that has the root dike in it. And they've gone back to Middle English and Old Anglo-Saxon and trying to introduce, and I like it, that when they discuss righteousness, they should use the old Middle English word, Anglo-Saxon roots, right wiseness. And doing righteousness is right wisen. We have that word likewise. We can add wise on everything. But it had its ancient roots in Anglo-Saxon of right wiseness. So this is what I've just shown you. What they say about righteousness. Well, because the English, as I've said, has two words, two roots, jus and justus, through the Latin, and rightwise, that's through the Anglo-Saxon roots. Not only do you have to go in this dictionary to righteousness, which I've just shown you and tired you with, you have to go to the other volume that has the J's in it, and justification and justice goes on and on and on and on. What's the point? I'm not ready to give it to you yet. Now, we have spent a lot of time on this word righteousness, you might think. I've even linked it to the rectum. So called because it's the straightest channel. I thought it might be interesting to add where we get justification. Justificare is the word in the Latin. Ficare is to make. We have in the Spanish, hacer. The Latinos, ¿es correcto? Hacer, to make. The Latin or the Italian, fare, to make. Facere in the Latin, in the passive tense, because it's something that happens as this unveiling over here, or revealing as it's translated, is to make. In the passive tense fieri of ficare in the Latin, is to make just, justificare, or justum fieri, to make just. It's something that's done to us. And I've often simplified it when I teach by saying, since God is righteousness, and God is just, and He is that He is, and can say, I am that I am, and the hunger of man to find a standard that he can call right and just, that produced all the labors that we've gone over, from deifying it as the daughter of Zeus, who enforced the will of Zeus, and then powerful people would determine what the will of Zeus was, since he apparently wasn't talking, to a natural law, this hunger to find that makes us sit in judgment on God Himself, because we got to convince ourselves it's right, when finally it is understood God is the self-definer and the self-revealer of justice and what is right. He is the benchmark of eternity. All things relate to that, and He expressed His nature and desire and will of what He would approve of abstractly in a law that was designed, as Paul looks back, to be a teacher to tell us we can't. We cannot measure to His standard. We can't rise anymore. If righteousness were flying and we had to do it on our own effort, we can jump a little bit, and some jump higher than others, and climb trees and whatever, but we can't make it as an abstract law. Only He could do it, and thus only He, moving into a tent of human flesh, with His own nature incarnate, could lift that flesh to a performance of the law that, when fulfilled, could pass away without contradicting God's declaration of the covenant, every jot and tittle pass fulfilled before it passes away. And if God is self-defined then as righteousness, then wherever He is the energy, energizing, displaying, radiating force or power that defines everything He does as righteous. He can do no bad. Well, what about when He punishes the wicked? That's the point. Whatever He does, if He is right. It takes us a while to figure out, and if we are presumptuous enough to dare to put Him on trial as the Israelites did, He may get sufficiently PO'd at us to blot us out. Whatever He does is righteous. And I think I've done pretty good to bring our understanding of righteousness to at least the point that it is a covenant relationship, and God, when He judges us, is relating to us in a covenant relationship, and He imputes to us a righteousness based upon faithfulness and covenant, and He demonstrates that He is a faithful covenant keeper, and that righteousness for practical purposes is keeping of covenant with anybody, and righteousness before God is covenant keeping with God, which is being like Him who keeps His covenants with us. The existential state of being righteous is something that can only radiate from God Himself. So He takes our faith covenant, a new covenant, He takes our faith in His word of covenant, that if we trust Him and become hearers of faith and run to Him, the sayer of His word, He will take that, as part of the covenant, new covenant, as righteousness. Now, there's still the yearn. But I want to be righteous. Well, He is righteous, and therefore, if you want to be righteous, you have to become Him. His nature has to come in you until, literally, you become a new creature as Jesus was an incarnation with a greater degree of His glory life than the implant of the Spirit. And the implant of the Spirit gives us the hope from glory to glory that we shall be like Him in an immortalized body over there. But it is the same happening. It is a coming together of our essential self in this crock of clay, to literally translate. We have this treasure in earthen vessels. And a coming together of God's life in us, the same life that raised up Jesus from the dead, and becoming the motivating and the driving and the compelling and the effectual force in our life to bring forth the fruit of the Spirit like a graft onto an old black walnut tree that changes its nature to English walnut. We become like Him. Metamorphosed is the word we're maybe going to get to today. You know what metamorphosis is, and that's the Greek word for metamorphosis that is the root from it, because it's a cognate word when wood turns to stone over a slow process of literal change. We are metamorphosed with the indwelling Spirit contained and maintained within. We are metamorphosed into the self-same image. Glory to glory, until the gospel received results, I repeat, in the twin happening of being taken as just like God, though we're not, justified, taken as though we're just like God, placed by imputation in Christ, as the God side of the promised covenant, that when we trust Him, that's the way He will take us. But He's also going to make us. I said, Thar, Bari, Basere, make just by putting in us His life, that as we not start wrestling to be like Him, but as we continue every step of the journey, trusting, ever-increasing faith, ever-increasing ingraftation and metamorphosis from glory to glory, the full sanctification, which is separation from the house of flesh to the immortal that we will have over there, will be done by the God of peace and eternity, the Thessalonian letter says. But the key is the maintenance of the presence And having said that, the whole book of Romans is unveiling God's righteousness. The whole book of Romans is the expanding of the understanding of the gospel. We've simplified it. It is God's word. And from Ephesians, God has bound himself to give his blessings, eulogia, to the church by a word. God's good word is the gospel, the heart of the content, death, burial, and resurrection. From that, back through the whole book, we see the types of this gospel and read it with understanding, looking through the gospel. And after those events in history, we see the power of the Spirit explained and unfolded as God's Son sits in his exalted position as Son of God of power. So the whole book of Romans will expand these kernels, really, I'm laying down. So with that having been said, we now come to a statement added to what the gospel of God's good word through Christ brings. Not only is it the power of God unto salvation, for righteousness of God in it, away from covering, burial, veil. There's a noun, kaluma, which means veil. Now this is one of the most profound subjects stated in a half sentence that God in the Old Testament typifies through a series of passages from the 24th chapter of Exodus through the 34th, and which Paul in Hebrews and other letters expands upon, but particularly in 2 Corinthians 3 and 4, what he is referring to here is expanded. I'm sure you've looked at this, and you see your translation, revelation, revealed. Is that what it says? For the righteousness of God, in it the gospel, is revealed. Right? Epistios, epistios, eis pistin, from faith to faith. But right now I'm concentrating on, in it, the gospel, apokalyptitai, is revealed. How many of you know what revelation means? Well, apocalypse, that, you know, is where we get the name of the last book of the Bible. The book of Revelation. The book of apokalyptitai. Now, you've grown up in the church in Sunday school. Any fool Christian knows what revelation means. How come you're not as bold as when I ask you what the gospel, or ask you what's the salvation? How many of you understand gospel a little better? How many understand salvation a little better? How many understand righteousness maybe a little better? I've already told you the preposition away from. The righteousness of God in the gospel moves away from something or takes something away. Burial or veil. I can tell you without boring you by reading. In the roots, it's very often, in fact, predominantly, there's a hint of death somewhere in the reference when derivatives of this word, the part of it here being kaluptitai, the verb or the noun, is used. It's a covering, a burial, a veil, like the veil in front of the Holy of Holies, or the veil that Moses put over his face when he came down and the people were frightened because of his shining face. And the explanation of that veil in 2 Corinthians 3, there's something usually dying or been dying or going to die in the vicinity, and it's even used as a verb to simply explain burial in the ground. Something away from covering that which is associated with death, an unveiling. Exodus 24. Open your King James. We don't have to get into a lot of Hebrew for this. Pretty simple narrative. Exodus 22. That's the second book of the Bible. Just start and spin through Genesis and you'll get there. Exodus 24. Moses went up, 15th verse. Moses went up into the mount. Mount Sinai, that is. And a cloud covered the mount. A type of heaven. He went up to God. Then the glory of the Lord abode upon Mount Sinai. And the cloud covered it 6 days. And the seventh day he called unto Moses out of the midst of the cloud. Now listen to this. And the sight of the glory of the Lord was like devouring fire on the top of the mount, and the eyes of the children of Israel. Last phrase, and Moses was in the mount 40 days. And 40 nights. Kind of interesting parallel, since he's a type of our mediator. He went up to the place of glory and stayed there 40 days and 40 nights. In Christ, the glory came down, even emphasized by descending on his head at the baptism. And he went into the wilderness to meet the devil on our behalf, 40 days and 40 nights. In those 40 days, God gave to Moses, chapter after chapter, the order to make the tabernacle, which would be his temporary dwelling place. The glory would come down from the mountain after he made the tabernacle and would dwell at least once a year, called the Shekinah glory, the only thing they could use to describe the presence of God when it would descend into the Holy of Holies, behind the 7.5-foot linen fence that walled the tabernacle away from the people, and the tabernacle's outside the camp, the curtains of the tent proper that was inside the court, and the sacrifices that prepared the representative, the priest, to go in, a curtain, a veil, a covering of the holy place, and then it's only referred to as the veil that separated the holy place from the Holy of Holies, where the Ark of the Covenant, containing what hasn't yet been produced in the chapter I'm in, God's symbol of standard, the law and the two tablets of stone. The first one's broken because of the sin of the people and the anger of Moses. The second one put inside the ark to typify that only the ark, which did typify Christ, only he would keep it. And the mercy seat above, and as atonement was made on the great day of atonement, and the high priest would walk in. If the sacrifice was acceptable, the Shekinah glory, God's They could only describe it as a shining, brilliant light. Shekinah glory inside this tent would settle down between the cherubims with folded wings and grant forgiveness of sins for a year. I want you to get this concept of light. When Christ went up a mount and was transfigured in the New Testament, and they awoke, the description is, he shone all over, radiated. When the resurrected Christ, in full power of restoration, as the last appearance, for Paul said, and last of all, he appeared to me as one born out of due time. And Paul's knocked from his horse on the road to Damascus. There's words, a voice, and light. Bright, shining light. Now, don't sit and read these papers I've handed you instead of listening to me. I'll tell you when you need to look at the paper. I don't teach anybody holding a paper in front of their eyes. What I'm talking about ain't on the paper. If that telegraphs to me, you ain't interested in what I'm saying. If you ain't interested in what I'm saying, out of here. This is one of the most important lessons that I will teach on Romans. And it's hard enough for me to try to compress it down in the time I have. You may have detected it from other visible signs. I have little patience today with anyone not willing to work. And to work to understand. And when I'm finished, maybe you'll understand the salvation of your soul is related to how hard you are working and seeing. Light. Everywhere, the best description that can be given of God's presence. And when I go into the books to trace the roots of the word glory in the English language, it's one of the least explained. It's one of those words you almost have to have an intuitive feel for. It's God's blazing forth eminence and radiance, a visual ineffable, which means incapable of being described, must be experienced, blast of himself, and rooted in light. About all we can find in descriptions from those who encounter it. Light. Light. Now the times, and I've told you, the Shroud of Turin is not a foundational basis for my faith in the resurrection. But if the resurrection occurred, and if there was a dead body in that shroud, and if it was Christ, the resurrection would explain the image. All the research is boiled down to an image caused by a radiation energy source we don't yet know how to define, that put a three-dimensional image in the cellular or cellulose of these flax fibers, that the closer the radiation source to the cloth, the deeper the imprint. Thus, we have a three-dimensional image, burned in, scorched in, on one side only. For the purposes of today, instead of resurrection, which tends to include such happenings as Lazarus and the daughter that was raised. Lazarus was not a resurrection, as was Jesus. It was just a restoration of the life he had. So for purposes of discussion today, I'd prefer to use the word, when Jesus resurrected, immortalized. Because into his body came a blast of life-giving divine energy. I'd better say life energy itself, that takes a three-day dead body. That's why I hate the heathen concept of the Middle Ages of Good Friday. It only leaves him in the tomb a piece of 2 days and one whole day. He was crucified on Wednesday, laid in the tomb, laid there 72 hours, a three-day-old dead body. Immortalized in an instant. A blast of energy like had never hit a fleshly body, a human person, of which he was in his incarnation as much human as divine, now dead. And only the human part of him dead there. And a blast of life immortalized the human remains. That never happened before. And the energy source in what is always described as light hit him. Other times, yesterday, no matter what I get on, here come the parade. Yesterday's Times, the religion section on the news side, points out that this year is one of the rare years. I like to go there on my birthday because it'd be available. This route of Turin will be put on display again this year. And then they glibly say, carbon-14 dating proved it to be a medieval cloth about 1260 A.D. Thus a fraud. Well, the news media is not always right, you know. Earlier, the archaeologists, this is the result, well, they said, in 1988, it was proved a fraud in 1988. They're kind of dated, aren't they? I think it's the year 2000, 12 years later. But in 1986, before it happened, the archaeologist William Meacham pointed out in the 1986 Hong Kong Shroud Symposium, there appears to be an unhealthy consensus approaching the level of dogma among both scientists and lay commentators that C-14 dating will settle the issue once and for all time. This attitude simply contradicts the general perspective of field archaeologists and geologists who view possible contamination as a very serious problem in interpreting the results of radiocarbon measurements. I find little awareness of the limitations of the C-14 method. Statements quoted from Shroud researchers, both pro and con, reveal an unwarranted trust in radiocarbon measurement, to produce an exact calendar date. I doubt anyone with significant experience in dating archaeological samples would dismiss the potential danger of contamination and other sources of error. No responsible field archaeologist would trust a single date or a series of dates on a single feature to settle a major historical issue. No responsible radiocarbon scientist would claim that it was proven that all contaminants had been removed and that the dating range was its actual calendar date. Well, carbon 14, what is it? Am I boring you? Scientists tell us that life on Earth is carbon-based, and that in the food chain, all living things, whether human, animal, or plant, ingest carbon, especially carbon 12 and carbon 13, which are stable atoms. That is, atoms likely to hold on to their electrons. And unstable, radioactive carbon 14 in much smaller quantities. While something is alive, it contains C12 and C13 in high quantities. Am I boring you? Is this too much for... I mean, you know, Christianity's not supposed to have a brain, is it? C12 and C13, while something's alive in high quantities, C14, very small quantities. But to skip ahead, there's a constant, measurable ratio of C12 to C14 in the organism as long as it's alive. But when it dies, that constant ratio doesn't stay the same, and the stable atoms stay stable. But when the living object dies, it begins to lose its C14, carbon 14. And it's been found that they decay at a certain rate. So the ratio between the 12 and 13 carbons and the 14 carbon begins to change. And the carbon 14 begins to decay at what's called a half-life rate, a period of time it takes to lose half after the plant or animal or carbon-bearing life dies. It starts losing that C14, and it loses half of its life every 5,730 years. Got that? Now, carbon-14 has dated the shroud at 1260 A.D. They've got it pinned down. Because, apparently, they have dated the life... This is going to poke me to death. The life of the carbon-14 decay on a pattern. It's been losing its life from what the ratio would have been when the shroud was made, and therefore, when the shroud was made and the flax died, the carbon-14 began to decay, and the ratio changed between the C12 and 13 and the C14, and you can now determine that the C14 has lost, apparently not a half-life, because then 5,730 years, and they've dated it. Got that? All right. Let me tie this on and leave it on now. It was submitted to test in 1988. What they had was a little edge of the shroud, and they cut a little piece that resulted in three postage stamp-sized pieces. Postage stamp about the size of your front half of your thumb. Send to three different chosen scientific places. I could really use up my message by telling you how the thing is done. It's pretty complicated, what they swirl and the actual test procedure. Carbon and other atoms and molecules extracted from the sample are electrically charged and hurled through a series of magnetic fields by a special nuclear accelerator called a tandem accelerator mass spectrometer. Now, everybody loves to sound intelligent as they talk about carbon-14 dating is established as a fraud now. These fields deflect atoms of varying mass and electrical charge, so they strike different regions of a detector target. Heavier atoms are deflected less by the magnetic fields than are lighter atoms, and this difference separates the trajectory of atoms according to their masses. By counting the atoms that strike any part of the detector, the apparatus can estimate their abundance. All right? Postage stamp size samples of the shroud were utilized. The linen was first carefully cleansed using both chemical and mechanical methods. Next, the sample was burned in oxygen, the postage stamp, thereby converting the carbon in its molecules into carbon dioxide gas. The gas was then reduced to pure carbon in the form of graphite by heating the gas in the presence of iron powder. In the next stage, the graphite derived from the shroud sample, consisting of a mixture of stable carbon isotopes with radioactive C-14, was bombarded by heavy cesium atoms. You still with me? Now, I would not be as offended if you read paper while I read this. But when I'm teaching Bible, and get back to Exodus, I won't see paper in front of anybody's face. In fact, I wouldn't be too offended if I even saw some eyes and you took a little nap getting ready for the next phase. This process knocked carbon atoms loose from the graphite, endowed some of them with electric charges, and sent them toward the accelerator. Now that we understand, going toward the accelerator. Every day we see that on the freeway. And I am convinced that some of those drivers should be carbon dated. Sometime before dinosaurs. By passing accelerated carbon atoms through argon gas, I ain't touching that, the instrument next stripped electrons from the carbon atoms, thereby giving them positive charges. You can read commentaries on Romans for 2,000 years, and nobody ever dealt with this while teaching on Romans. Thought I'd say that. In the process, background molecules having the same masses as carbon atoms are removed, eliminating a potential source of error. Finally, the electrically charged carbon atoms emerging from the accelerator were sorted out by magnetic fields, permitting precise measurement of the ratio between carbon-14 and carbon-12. All from postage stamp. Unfortunately, as often happens, the newspapers printed the results prematurely. Now, I'm not going to bore you with that. Since 1988, ignored by even the Times today, a number of scientists have carefully examined the results of the C-14 tests and have seriously challenged its results, claiming that the tests were performed in such a manner as to call into question the reliability of the data. The C-14 test, normally reliable under very controlled circumstances, such as the whole shroud, was studying an object subjected to many historical events and highly contaminated. The C-14 test was out of balance with many other scientific tests that confirmed the antiquity of the cloth, and that's abundant. The data was now subjected to serious scrutiny by the scientific community. The scientists who conducted the carbon-14 test were very concerned with the potential of foreign elements that might affect the test on the shroud, as was noted in the report in Nature magazine. Throughout history, the shroud was exposed to many and varied contaminants. The exposure of the shroud linen to washing in soap prior to its being used as a burial cloth, many other contaminants combined with questionable cleaning of the test patches likely threw off test results. Such contaminants as ointments, aloes and myrrh, sweat, blood, saliva, candle wax, and smoke from the candles, finger oils from continued handling by the faithful in earlier years, atmospheric dust, limestone dust from the tomb, carbon or calcium carbonate, dirt, travertine aragonite, pollen, mites, mold, mildew, and the smoke, soot, and steam water from the 1532 fire where it was doused, all contribute to the litany of contaminants that left their marks on this route over 2,000 years. Dr. Dmitry Kuznetsov of the Biopolymer Laboratory in Moscow developed a laboratory model in 1994 to simulate the physical, chemical conditions of the 1532 Chambery fire. When the fire caused them to have to douse and part of the shroud was burned. His findings, reported in the Journal of Archaeological Science, January 1996, maintain that a chemical modification of the textile cellulose of the shroud, carbonization by the introduction of carboxyl COOH, resulting from the 1532 fire, impacted the C14 dating. This rejuvenation of the linen was caused when the intense heat, 960 degrees Celsius, generated by the fire, and the supersteam vapor caused from the dousing with water created a chemical action of melting silver from the reliquary and the silk backing of the shroud with cellulose of the linen fibers, adding carbon-14 isotopes and thereby suggesting a younger, rejuvenated cloth. Test samples were taken from a restored area of selvage. Times didn't tell us that this morning, did they? All other kinds of problems. Bioplastic coating. As reported in the journal Radiocarbon in 1986, scientists used C14 to date an Egyptian bull mummy linen. The wrappings from an ancient Egyptian burial, as well as two Peruvian linen cloths. The same method was used. It demonstrated, because they knew the age of these, they dug them out of the graves. It demonstrated that the method is somewhat wanting in accuracy with regard to linen. On the Egyptian mummy linen, the dates range from 3440 to 4517, spanning 1100 years. The known age of the cloth was 3000 B.C., The closest date C14 could produce was 2528, requiring a calibration of 472 years to correct it. Are you still with me? I'm not even to talk about these others. Potentially the most damaging single piece of evidence to controvert the 1988 test results comes from the reported disclosure that there was a secret dating of the shroud conducted at a California nuclear accelerator facility in 1982. Separate ends of a single thread, a little smaller than a postage stamp, were dated with one end dating 200 A.D. and the other end of the same thread dating 1000 A.D. 800-year divergence. The wide divergence in dating on the same thread should, he notes, be alarming to those who consider the 1988 test definitive. In addition, the one end of the thread would place the dating closer to the time of Jesus than the radiocarbon dating on the bull mummy linen, which was 400 and some years off. But the reason I'm on this, I repeat, my faith will not be affected at all if the Shroud of Turin is fake. I've gotten so sick of the mass of relics without bases that populate the Holy Lands. I used to take a guided tour of the Holy Lands, and unlike most people, wouldn't even start in Jerusalem for the simple reason of all the relics that cover sacred spots, and I would start up on Mount Carmel above Haifa, where Elijah roamed free, and where Elijah demonstrated the power of God. And the last place I ended up was Jerusalem. I'm as turned off as most people on relics that have no basis. A toe of Peter here. A the jawbone of an ass there. But the Shroud of Turin has a history, and it deserves. It's been subjected to scrutiny considerable. And it deserves better, just like the resurrection deserves better, than turning it down because it presupposes a miracle. If the glory of God and the energizing life that immortalized Jesus' body was in that shroud, forget all the other reasons for carbon 14 to be ignored. Forget them all. But nobody wants to consider this because that would presuppose the resurrection. That would presuppose supernatural life. They admit it is a scorched theory. It is, and if it was in 1260 A.D., same method. But the only people saying 1260 A.D., and isn't it interesting they picked that date because somebody in the Middle Ages said it was a fraud and painted. Now they've proved there's no dyes, no paints, not. It's a scorched theory. It was scorched on. With some energy source, best described as light, more so than just pure heat, but light and heat. And if we believe in this immortalization happening, the life generated, raised from mortality to immortality, not just restoration of life, total transformation of this fleshly body that he took, weak and capable of death in all respects as us, suddenly transformed into an immortalized body. Metamorphosis instant. That happened. British philosopher Geoffrey Ashe suggests that Jesus underwent an unparalleled transformation in the tomb. Ashe wrote, "It's least intelligible that the physical change of the body at the resurrection may have released a brief and violent burst of radiation, perhaps scientifically identifiable, perhaps not, which scorched the cloth. In this case, the shroud image is a quasi-photograph of Christ, I'm going to use the word, immortalized to life, produced by a kind of radiance or incandescence analogous to heat and its effects." Some physicists begin to suspect that the shroud was exposed to a milliburst of radiation that seared the shroud with a burst of blinding light rather than heat. Dr. Anthony N. Perut of Rhode Island states, "I'd suggest that the radiation energy that imprinted the bodily image in the cloth, the blood marks are natural, altered the fibers of the cloth and changed the relative number of carbon isotopes on the linen material. This would render radio dating the age of this unique cloth impossible to determine. Transmutation of elements, that is, changing one element into another or an isotope into another isotope of the same element, on the order of 10 to the 6th power to 10 to the 8th power calories and occur with wavelengths of about 10 to 4 angstroms. As a matter of fact, it is these kinds of energetic cosmic rays from the sun that are the cause of the formation of carbon 14 in the first place." So if that burst of life occurred, the carbon 14 molecules would have had a change, rejuvenated in the process. So much for the God of this world that is determined to make doubters instead of faithers. I only want to say one thing. The difference between the evidence and reliability of carbon 14 dating the shroud and the evidence to prove the resurrection of Jesus Christ apart from the shroud is like trying to compare Mount Everest with one of these low hills around in the city limits of Los Angeles. But you won't find the mouthpiece of the God of this world, the media, proclaiming the miracle of the resurrection as one-sidedly and as absolute fact as this attempt to totally dismiss the shroud as fraud on such shaky foundation. And if the resurrection occurred, I don't know whether Jesus was in that shroud. I don't even know whether the shroud is genuine or not. I am convinced a dead body was in it and had all the identical marks of Christ, and something caused a scorched image that's three-dimensional, and that if the resurrection occurred, and if God's presence is light as we see through Scripture, and if that impact of the immortalization of His body occurred, I don't have to look for another explanation. Carbon 14's out the window, because God's life in Christ that scorched the image blew the carbon 14 ratio. That's all that needs to be said on all the other stuff I've read. But now back to Exodus. Moses comes down from the hill. And as he comes down from the hill, having gotten the pattern from God, from Exodus 24, clear over to Exodus 32. God is now designing with the mediator on that hill, which we have seen. A cloud has to cover it because of the blazing glory of God's presence on the mountain. Brilliant light. And God is now divining and giving the exact plan of how He would dwell with them inside a veiled tent as Shekinah glory, bright light. How many of you have heard and read out-of-the-body experiences, deathbed experiences described as people going toward a brilliant light? Well, they're the lucky ones. What's behind that light? I don't know. We see through glass darkly, Paul says. We'll see. I know that Jesus will be as He was, immortalized, the God-man eternal. But the capacity to get through that light, see what's behind, tells me they were going the right direction. This mystery of light through the Scripture becomes the threshold of encounter with God. So he said, a bright light from heaven. In fact, F.W. Farrar, one of the greatest students of Scripture in time, postulated the theory ridiculous because he didn't believe in the devil and demons. When Paul talks about his thorn, he says it's a messenger from Satan. That's all you need to know. But those that try to find some natural explanation of Paul's thorn, F.W. Farrar said he had ophthalmia, bleeding eyes or pussy-filled eyes as a result of the bright light that blinded him temporarily until he went to the house of Damascus and was healed. That wasn't the case. I mean, Paul isn't going around saying, be healed, and they're saying, what about you? Is the pustulence down his face? You know, some people are so ridiculous it hardly deserves attention. But the bright light was there. Now, where did I lose these claws? These could be a weapon. Finally, in the 32nd chapter, we read, when the people saw that Moses delayed to come down out of the mount, the people gathered themselves together unto Aaron and said unto him, up, make us gods which shall go before us. For as for this Moses, the man that brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we wot not what is become of him. Aaron said, give me your earrings. Threw them in the fire. Moses comes down from the mountain with Joshua. Joshua had been sitting there in Never Never Halfway Land. He don't know what's going on the mountain, and he doesn't know what's going on in the camp. But Like most know-nothings, he has more to say than anybody. As they hear the noise of the camp, he says, "It's war." And then they got a little closer. Says, "No, it's party. They're singing." Moses already knew. God told him. As if he needed Joshua to tell him. But here's rattle-mouthed Joshua, still in the learning stage, telling Moses, and he's wrong in both counts. And Moses sees it. Breaks. And his anger serves God's type in that case because the first edition of the law is broken in man's hands. He breaks the tablets of stone that God had hewn out and written with his own finger on both sides. And then again to typify the death that's associated with the law, which is what we're getting to in this unveiling here. I've not left it. I'll lead you back to this apocalypti. The giving of the law resulted in 3,000 being killed that very day. Now, I like Pastor Moses' concern about popular opinion, because he ground up the calves and made the golden calves and made gold dust soup and made them eat it. Now, there's a lot that goes along with that. Can you imagine where their attention would be for some days thereafter? Panning for gold. I mean, the brilliance of that punishment, almost worse than death. My gold, I have to watch for it. I have to study bleep for days. This is the calf I worshipped. Look at it. I ate it, and here it is. You know, there's a lot of poetry in the Bible. Poetic meanings you have to pay attention to, but I'm going somewhere else. Moses went back up on the mountain. This time God made him chisel out the two slabs, but God still wrote on them. And he comes down from the mountain this second time. But before he comes down, he says something to God. Go to the 34th chapter. He says to God, verse 18 of the 33rd chapter, not the 34th, "I beseech thee," Moses speaking, "show me thy glory." This word again. And God said, "I will make all my goodness pass before thee, and I will proclaim the name of the Lord before thee, and will be gracious to whom I will be gracious, will show mercy on whom I will show mercy." And he said, "Thou canst not see my face, so there, because there shall no man see me and live." And the Lord said, "Behold, there's a place by me, and thou shalt stand upon a rock, and it shall come to pass while my glory passeth by, that I will put thee in a cliff of the rock, and will cover thee with my hand while I pass by, and I will take away mine hand, and thou shalt see my back parts, but my face thou shalt not see." Now, apparently, there are degrees of radiance of this glory that is always associated with light. And to even see his backside, whatever that means in the complicated Hebrew, he has to hide him in the shadow of a cleft of a rock, and he only gets a glimpse. But remember, I'm talking about radiation. and the power of this immortalizing force, and I hope you're already ahead of me and behind me what I've said about Paul coming presence to introduce the power of God and the metamorphosis, which is the righteousness of God in and through us. This life energizing force, you're already ahead of me, is what the power of the Holy Spirit in us as a gift from God is to do within us. A measure of it. What's the effect of even this hidden in the cleft of the rock in the shadows? Exposure to the light called the glory of God. All right, go to the 34th chapter. It came to pass, verse 29, when Moses came down from Mount Sinai with the two tables of testimony in Moses' hand, when he came down from the mount, that Moses wist not that the skin of his face shone while he talked with him. And when Aaron and all the children of Israel saw Moses, behold, the skin of his face shone. And they were afraid to come nigh him. And Moses called unto them, and Aaron and all the rulers of the congregation returned unto him, and Moses talked with them, and afterward all the children of Israel came nigh, and he gave them in commandment all that the Lord had spoken with him in Mount Sinai, and till. You have till in italics, don't you? Added by the translators. And when. If you're going to add anything, it's and when, because all it says, and Moses had done speaking with them. He, Moses, put a veil on his face. But when Moses went in before the Lord to speak with him, that is the Lord, he took the veil off until he came out. And he came out, still with the veil off, and spake unto the children of Israel that which he was commanded. And the children of Israel saw the face of Moses, that the skin of Moses' face shone. And Moses put the veil on his face again, until he went in to speak with him. Now, why did he do that? And I can tell you, the same word in the Septuagint is translated with the noun of this passive verb, veil. What he put on was what this verse says is taken away. He put on a veil. Same word in the Greek translation, Septuagint, we have here. Why did he do that? Now, you don't yet know what revelation means. You're getting there. You all know why he put the veil on, don't you? Well, we don't have to rely on you and me interpreting it, because Paul's done it. Go to 2 Corinthians 3. Verse 6. Speaking of his ministry, am I boring you? Speaking of his ministry, aren't you surprised I'm spending so much time in the King James? I don't trust these glasses with the Greeks. Speaking of his ministry, our sufficiency is of God, the end of the fifth verse, who also hath made us able ministers of the New Testament, not of the letter, but of the Spirit. For the letter killeth, but the Spirit giveth life. But if the ministration of death, written and engraved in stones, was glorious. That's one. There's going to be 14 times the word glory or its derivatives is going to be used. If the ministration of death, written and engraved in stones, that's those tablets that Moses came down and was holding in his hands as his face was shining, was glorious, that glory of his face, So that the children of Israel could not steadfastly behold the face of Moses for the glory, that's second time, of his countenance, which glory was to be done away with, brought to an end, finished, died. How shall not the ministration of the Spirit be rather glorious? That's four. Then he has another argument. Now, if this was, if the ministration of death, which was the glory associated with the giving of the law, which was to die, and could only condemn us to death, how much more glorious should shine the ministry of the Spirit? That's his first argument. If the ministration of condemnation, verse 9, be glory, you may be saying, well, how could it be glory? Because it came from God. The imprint written with his fingers on the stone and the presence of his glory, the shining face. There was glory there. God did it. Paul, through the book of Romans, will point out the law was not bad, it was impotent. It was right as an expression of God's perfection stamped in flesh, but it had no power. It could only condemn. And he's saying, if the giving of that was glory, how much more giving of the Spirit? If the ministry of condemnation, which the law brings, be glory, much more doth the ministration of righteousness exceed in glory. For even that which was made glorious, so he had to veil his face, had no glory in this respect by the reason of the glory that excelleth. In other words, when you get out-gloried, you're out-gloried. We all know this, a dim light. Turn on a brilliant light, and the dim light is no longer noticed. This will be known as the message where he wrestled with the glasses. If that which is done away, gone, was glorious, much more that which remaineth is glorious. Stay with me. Seeing then that we have such hope, we use great boldness, literally, of speech, not as Moses, which put a veil over his face, that the children of Israel could not steadfastly look to the end of that which is abolished. But their minds were blinded. For until this day remaineth the same veil untaken away in the reading of the Old Testament, which veil is done away in Christ. Even unto this day when Moses is read, the veil is upon their heart. Nevertheless, when it shall turn to the Lord, and literally when anyone shall turn to the Lord, the veil shall be taken away. Now the Lord is that Spirit, and where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is liberty. For we all with open face, not beholding, reflecting, as in a glass, the glory of the Lord, are changed into the same image from glory to glory, even as by the Spirit of the Lord. A metamorphosis is what the word is in the Greek. Metamorphose from glory to glory. And if our gospel be hid in the third verse of the next chapter, fourth chapter, it is hid to them that are lost. Listen close. And whom the God, Theos, I'll bet most of you never ever dreamed that Satan would be referred to as Theos. Theos is the word in the Greek. The God of this world, in whom the God of this world hath blinded the minds of them which are pistis. Believe not. Always probing, questioning, agnostic, prideful asses who cannot believe. Blinded by the God of this world, who's blinded the minds of them which believe not, lest the light of the glorious gospel of Christ, who is the image of God, should shine into them. For God, who commanded the light to shine out of darkness, has shined in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. Now, what is this saying? I wish I had 30 minutes now. Why did Moses put the veil on? Because like a suntan, you stay out of the sun, and the suntan diminishes and fades. The encounter with God's energy light made the skin of his face shine, and they were in awe and afraid of it. The presence of God, as he stood there with the standard of God measuring them. And God didn't want them to see. Moses didn't want them to see. That old covenant, glorious as it was because given by God, good as it was because it did name what stamped in human flesh would be the perfection of God's standard, was given and doomed and predicated to die. And the awe they had that gave them the temporary ability to listen to God was God had enough of them. When he displayed his power, they got in line. When he was leading them into some trouble, they're turning on him. The law was destined to die. It had a schoolmaster temporary role. It was to die. It was to condemn. It was temporary. But he didn't want them to see the fading glory because they'd say, it's temporary. So hidden from them by the veil, as God's mediator came out, was the fact it was fading. Paul, in his day, sees the typological meaning that they still refuse to see that that glory, that display, that act of God died. And a new realm, the age of the Son of God with power that will not fade, has come on the scene. But they refuse to drop the veil and are still looking to that hidden behind the veil, which is still shining in their eyes. And therefore, they are unable to turn from looking at that which has died and that which condemns and that which cannot save. And God, and that's why this word is used, passive. Moses put the veil on. Here, it is passive. Someone else pulls the veil off to reveal a glory that is lasting, eternal, that will never fade. And this is the introduction into our availability of God's righteousness as his glory with no veil between that can change our life instead of condemn. All I could do today was set the stage for a fuller exposition of Paul's explanation of the purpose of this unveiling and the harsh reality still imitated by the Shawls when they worship in Jewish synagogues, of worshiping that which behind the veil was not revealed to be fading. All they saw was the shining face, and then it was veiled. And God kept from them at that time, in his economy of time, that this glory expression, which was the law, was destined to fade and die. Or else, the type would not have run its full course until in the fullness of time, God sent his Son to pull the veil away. And why do you think the veil in the temple the night he was crucified was rent from top to bottom? Not by human hands. The veil is removed. And that glory, that law, that instrument of condemnation, that writings of accusation, that list of perfect do's and don'ts with no power to save us was hidden behind a veil to die out of God's presence, that the new relationship, God at the fullness of time and the moment He burst from that tomb immortalized, rips the veil in that procedure of crucifixion, death, and resurrection, that an unveiled apokalupti, pulling away of that which veils the righteousness of God, which is immortalizing life placed within. Am I preaching, are you going to live an immortal life here? No! I'm preaching that the new life in you will live immortal and will lay this old body down as a garment, and the God of peace will sanctify us wholly over there. But the life that is God's righteousness is this same kind of life, energizing, immortalizing force, that without which there is no possibility through will worship and imitation you will ever be like God. You can't be. He can be in us. And that's my message to be finished next Sunday. Time. Now, frustratingly for me, scratch the surface of the Corinthian exposition of Paul. I'll take up there next Sunday as we hopefully will begin to understand what the gospel as good news really provides for us. There is life-changing power available. May God give me the ability to open your eyes. But the tragedy that Paul ended and I didn't have time to really get into is apparently in his temporary power as prince of the power of this world. Satan himself, as the god of this world, has the authority and power to blind the hearts of those. This is not just a preacher's job. It is a seeing job, a hearing job, as well as a preaching job. My prayer is that those trap doors that put you under Satan's control, fear, that is the antithesis of faith. Self-preservation, the opposite of self-denial. Questioning and doubting instead of hearers of faith make you a ready target for the God of this world that can blind your heart to the radiant life of God that can metamorphosize you from glory to glory into the self-same image. God grant it shall sweep through this congregation. I go to the rock. It's offering time. Good day, folks.